after all the effort to set this all up, I doubt we're going to get to it, but we'll see. Let me open with a word of prayer and we'll get started. Father, our God, we thank you for this another day which you have given us to serve you, to love you, to worship you. And we do pray to that end this morning that our time spent together will be spent doing all those things. And that particularly in this class, as we think about the practical ins and outs of raising children, that we would be given wisdom to meet the task which you have given us and to encourage those around us who are doing likewise. And we thank you for these things in Christ's name. Amen. I gave you all an article last week. I hope you all have read it and hoping you brought your copy with you. If you didn't, I have a couple extra copies I can give out. I just don't have enough for everybody, probably, so hopefully most people remembered. But okay. Give one to the Copelands. And you guys, anybody else need a copy? I've got a couple more. Pose? All right.
Thank you.
The, I don't know what that was. I don't know if I want to know what that was. We'll check on it after a while. All right, everybody go check on it. The boogeyman has been unleashed in the closet somewhere. So, I passed out this article last time, and, you know, like any other article that we're going to discuss, there are things in it that I think are worth going through. The thing that I think this article does for us, or I hope it will do for us, is it addresses an area that we really didn't spend that much time on. And what I mean is this. We in the beginning, you know, we talked about training your child to obey. And we talked about dealing with rebellion. We talked about spanking, discipline, what have you. And without explicitly saying so, during that process, the way I described the spanking process, and it was sort of a formal process in a sense, the different steps that you go through, things you do and don't do and all that, I had in my mind's eye somewhere along the line of toddlers to teens, kind of an age range that I was dealing with. I didn't say that particularly, I just said kids. And there were some questions that were raised along the way about what about younger, like toddlers or even infants? Is there a place for some kind of discipline at that level? And, you know, I think I answered those questions and talked about it a little bit. I think, you know, the watchword there was if they're old enough to understand, no, they're old enough to discipline, I think is what we said, and left it at that. When I read the book that these articles are taken from by Michael and Debbie Pearl, To Train Up a Child, one of the things that jumped off the page at me is that he spends a lot of time dealing with the infant, the toddler age. And all these articles are pretty much aimed at that age group. And so that made me think, you know, I didn't really speak to that too much. And the other thing that he brings out in these articles, as we'll see when we get digging into them a little bit, is that that's the best time to begin your work. And if you do your work well at that stage, you will have much less work left for you to do by the time you get to toddler and above. We've kind of been saying that, but I didn't really move it back this far. He does, and he gives some great examples, I think, and has some worthwhile things to say. But it may be that some of the things he says, you might not think that about, so that's why I want to open this up to the class and see what everybody thinks about what they read. So there was just a series of articles here, and this is pretty much chapter one of his book. I think I may have left out a few pieces just to get it all in four pages. Pretty much the first chapter of the book. I like the entire book. I would recommend it. There's one little piece of theology that I think he gets wrong. I think I mentioned this last time. I'll just mention it again today. and that is that he has a kind of an Arminian theology, and he has a kind of an idea of children reaching some age of accountability, which he never really defines. And in his mind's eye, they're not guilty before that age. They're innocent. I just think theologically that's really problematic. But it doesn't really contaminate his... I think his advice is still good, in spite of the fact that he's working from what I believe is a misguided theology. The only thing it does from time to time is that he uses some vocabulary terms that I found a little bit confusing until I understood that was where he was coming from. I said, okay, I see what he's saying. Well, I'll bring those up as we get to them. All right, so let's... we'll just start off with... we'll just take this one article at a time as we work through this. He talks about obedience training. He makes the point that, you know, most parents don't think they can train their little children. Of course, we know better than that. But he says training doesn't necessarily require the trainee to be capable of reason. And he compares it with, you know, he says even rats and mice can be trained to respond to stimuli. A dog can be trained. And not, you know, the first possible bad reaction somebody might have to this is say, hey, my kid's not a dog or a rat. Quit calling my kid a dog. And that's not the point. This is an argument that you use in logical terms called for the stronger reason. So if something over here can be done easily, then it stands to reason. You know, I can, if I can do the greater thing easily, then I can do the lesser thing easily. That's the way I should put it. So if I can throw a ball, you know, 50 yards, surely I can throw a ball 10 yards, right? So what he's saying here is, he's not saying that kids are rats or dogs or whatever. He's saying if you can train something of less intelligence and do it successfully, and obviously you can, then you should be able to do the easier thing, which is to train a child who has more capacity. So that's his point there. And he says proper training always works with every child. Very strong statement, but I think he backs it up, and I happen to agree with him about it. But I want to hear what you all have to think. Just at that point, Martin's got his hand up. Go, Martin.
Well, as I was reading this, I think it became very clear to me that there is a major distinction between training and discipline.
Yes.
I'm not so sure we know what that difference is.
Yes. I'm glad you picked up on that. That goes back to his age of accountability thing. Okay, so that was confusing. Because in my mind, spanking or discipline is a part of training. Now granted, it's not the only part of training. There are other elements that go with that. Just like when we describe spanking, we describe it as more than just the swinging of a rod at the buttocks or whatever. We had a whole thing that was put in place around that. The reason it goes with his age of accountability thing is because he tries to say that prior to the age of accountability, whatever that is, you're not really disciplined because they're not really sinning. They're not really they're not conscious of doing wrong, and they're not even accountable for doing wrong. They're innocent. But you still have to train them. Okay? I don't agree with that breakdown. But if you read what he describes here, he's describing discipline. He's describing as a part of his process, spanking or discipline or what have you. He just doesn't call it that.
I tend to think the distinction I would make is that discipline, doing the best you can with English language to define the terms, you can't have discipline without knowledge of doing something wrong.
Right.
You're going to say that a kid's too young to understand. I understood you picked the first one. The one I really liked was the Amish one.
Yeah.
I thought it was perfection.
Well, we're going to get there.
Well, that's an example of the difference between training and discipline.
Yeah.
So I think if you don't have a good understanding of what the two are, and I'm not saying they're distinct because they do overlap.
Yeah.
But there's an attitude. You know, which are we affecting here? It may look this way, but what are we trying to do in this particular case?
Right.
Are we training? Or they knew what they were doing was wrong. There was discipline. What is it?
Yeah.
I think that's a major issue.
My thinking is it's all part and parcel of the same thing. And if you look at it that way and go through his examples, it works just fine. I just don't like the vocabulary he ends up putting in there in places. He makes what seemed to be a distinction without a real distinction to be had. And it's because it goes back to the theological problem. That's how I see it playing out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, yeah.
I always thought there was a great distinction because, like, training is teaching them the right thing to do. Discipline is reinforcing it when they mess up.
Right.
But I always think of the illustration of being in the grocery store.
Yeah.
Where kids are screaming and yelling, and some mamas do nothing. They just ignore them, and we just listen to them scream. And others overreact and discipline them, spank them harshly. And then there's others who have trained their children at home to respond to correction and to accept mama said no. And they've been trained, so they're much less likely, not, doesn't mean they never will, but they're much less likely to have that fit in the store because they've been trained at home. That's the distinction I see between training and just reacting in discipline.
Yeah, and I, that would be a good distinction to make. It just depends on what you encompass in your mind by some of the use of the terms. If you think of discipline as encompassing the whole process of the training that goes with the discipline that has discipline in there along with other things, then it becomes kind of a funny statement. If you think of discipline as the specific act of spanking,
or other correction,
and then the other setup that goes on and the deliberate effort that goes into setting things up and so forth as a separate thing that goes with that, then you could take him that way too. I would see that working. What it boils down to, the way I see it, is that at a practical level, what he describes, the different examples he gives here, I think are great suggestions. Just the vocabulary could be confusing depending on how you take some of these terms. And I just wanted to, Martin's already brought it up. He kind of reacted the way I did when I first heard it. Yours is a legitimate way of taking him. It might not even create the problem in the first place. You might just say, well, I know what he means. He just means not just spanking. It involves something bigger than that. Kind of what you're saying, right? So, yeah, take him that way, and it works well also. Other thoughts on this?
Because, like, for instance, the train up a child verse, I've never thought of that as being just be sure you spank them when they do.
No, not just.
Yeah.
I can be including that, but yeah.
Training him in what is right.
Yeah, you're showing and training him, which we spent a lot of time talking about, the character traits. So it's much, much more than just spanking. So, yeah. All right, let's move on. That kind of introduces the idea. I think if we get past that, we got a lot of good examples here. First one he talks about is training not to touch. All the things he picks on are things that are classic toddler, infant, type scenarios, right? Very classic. This is the big one. He starts off telling us, a lot of satisfaction in training up a child. It's easy but challenging. And he said, when my children are able to crawl, in the case of one roll, around the room, he talks about setting up training sessions. So here's what I like about what he says in this section and really in all the other examples he gives. There's a proactive effort going on his part. I love that. And I think we may have hinted at that or talked about that in the sense that, don't train kids badly by not responding to when you should and so forth. But I don't know that we made it this clear. I like the clarity that he brings about the idea of you make it a point to set up a situation where you're going to be training that infant or that toddler. And you do it at your convenience. You do it at a time, meaning you do it at a time when you can take time, and that's what you're going to do. You're going to spend time doing that. You don't wait until you get in the grocery store and start trying that. That's a bad place to start training. It's a bad place to start training if you've got a really hard day going on, and you're getting phone calls or things are going on that are distracting around the house. I mean, I'm not saying you have to deal with discipline problems whenever they occur, obviously. But what he's saying is, find a time, a positive time when you can take the time and do your training then, and it will pay massive dividends during those other times when you can't really afford to give it the attention that you would like to give it. You won't need to because you did your work. You did your training ahead of time. Does that make sense to everybody? And what kind of thoughts did you have about that? He's talking here about, let's just see what it says. He talks about place an appealing object where they can reach it. And when the child spies it, they make a dive for it. So it may be something that's okay for them to even have. He doesn't say particularly. He just, this is a training session. So they go for this object, and you say, no, don't touch that. And, of course, the kid's going to look at you, and then they'll touch it, more than likely. And he says, you tell them no, and he recommends, you know, switching their hands. We're talking an infant. We're talking a very small child here. You don't have to get a big, giant paddle out. We're not, see, this is a, you accommodate the age here, and you're still disciplining. You're still, I would call this spanking in a sense. You could, people could argue the term, but it's fine. It's some kind of discipline. But you're basically, you're inflicting a little pain in their little brain, so it goes, oh, well, I hear no, and I touch, ouch. A little sting comes up. And
he,
yeah.
Did he literally made a switch, or a little old finger play?
He may have literally meant switch, but I don't have a problem with a finger, necessarily. And if a young child like that, what's your thought?
Well, I think the point was, the deal is that there has to be a painful something.
Yes.
Otherwise, there's no understanding at all.
That's right. So whether it happens to be, he later, in one of his other sections, he defines it as a specific dimension and everything else.
I was thinking that in most cases, the finger doesn't do anything. But my darn father's did, and it made a welt. So, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
If that's the intent, fine. I'm good with that.
Yeah, I mean, you want something that'll sting but doesn't do damage on a permanent level. So even, I try to avoid whelps, you know, but you want it to sting. You mentioned that, I just say that. Yeah, a snap of the, a flick.
That was more painful than us just hitting with our finger, but...
Okay.
You're always armed.
Yeah, you're always armed.
So what we're doing here is we're making a distinction between that and a love tap.
Making a distinction what?
Between that and a love tap.
Well, yeah, but I'm assuming what you mean by love tap is something where you go through the motions but it doesn't inflict any pain.
Exactly.
That would be a big problem. In fact, even when we talk about spanking, we talk about it has to hurt. Remember we said that was one of our points about spanking. And at this level, even if it's not a formal thing with a normal, what you think of with a paddle or a bigger rod or what have you, like you would use on an older child, it's still, the principle's still there. It needs to hurt, otherwise it does no good. The pain is what does the training. And even God, when he disciplines us, I mean, a big paddle doesn't come down from the sky and hit us in the rear end when we do something wrong. What does God do to discipline us? He does discipline us. Hebrews talks about that. What's he do? He brings circumstances into your life that are painful, normally an outgrowth of your sin, and it teaches you no. I mean, that's basically right. You know, I mean, God does it, and even when he disciplines, without a paddle. So there are age-appropriate things, which we will, I've incorporated and we'll discuss when we get back to our outline, but probably not today. So here, yeah, flick, something, as long it's got to inflict pain. Is the point, or it's not going to do any good. But it doesn't have to be severe, overwhelming pain. At this point, they're in the early stages, and they'll be pretty responsive to just a little bit of pain. You know, you're not out to really put the hurt on them. This isn't punishment, making them pay for their sin. It's not like that. This is training in that sense. So I would go with him on that. It's training in the sense that the pain just makes an association so that they learn. When you say no, you mean no. And he sets up a situation that's perfect. You know, you get to set the time. You get to set the place. And you can do it on a leisurely afternoon or a leisurely morning when you have plenty of time. And as he points out, it doesn't take long. He said it may take several times, but if you're consistent, they'll learn to consistently obey even in your absence. And he talks about the children will remain happy and obedient, and you will never need to tell them twice as a rule. You won't need to. That would be great, wouldn't it? That's the way it should work. And if you've done something like this and you've been deliberate about it, you can make it to where it comes out that way. And then he has this saying. Some people say, child-proof your home. I say, home-proof your child. I like that. I think that's right. He's not in favor of putting things out of reach, pulling things out of reach. Because all that says is, you know, I can't stop you unless I get something out of your reach. Now, of course, there's common sense about this. You don't throw razor blades in a playpen, right? But the point is that you don't, as a rule, make moving things out of the way your approach to the child. Maybe you might need to do that in a situation where you just can't deal with it right then and temporarily or something, but he's encouraging us to, and I think he's right, set up these training sessions where that's not how it's handled. You say no and you inflict pain. Other thoughts on this one? Yeah, Stephen. Yeah.
And the Lloyd's house is actually a perfect place for training on that, because we have to park usually on the street whenever I go to get her. And so we come out, and of course for a long time I was telling her what we do, you know, when we get to the street. So now I'll let her kind of walk ahead of me, and I'll look both ways, there's no cars coming. So I'll just watch to see what she does.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes she'll stop, sometimes she'll just try to cross the street, so then I'll say, stop. And, you know, sometimes she'll stop right then, sometimes she'll keep going, but it's a good opportunity for me to see what will she do if I'm not right there, you know, guiding her. And obviously, you know, if she does the wrong thing, then we deal with that.
Yeah, right, right.
But a lot of times it is helpful, because I've seen where I don't, you know, I'm not even saying anything to her, I just kind of back off and she'll stop and she'll look both ways, and then she'll kind of look for me to hold her hand when we go into the street.
Yeah. That sounds good. It sounds like you're kind of doing in principle what he's talking about here. And again, it's doing it at a time when you can set it up and you can have control of the situation. There's not any dangers, there's not any distractions, interference. And it makes your job so much easier, and it makes it so much more effective. And the beauty of it is the carryover into times when you can't take that kind of time. So someday when you tell her stop and you aren't in a position to go grab her, and the truck or a car coming, if you've trained her well, she will do it, and you'll save her life. Literally. He tells a story. It's not in one of these stories. He tells a story later in his book. I think Kennard referenced it last time we met, if I remember, at some point, where his daughters, they were a little older, and they were in a truck where he thought the truck was getting ready to explode for some reason. It was something to do with a short or a battery or something. I forget the exact circumstance. But anyways, I think the window was only like partway down or something like that, and they had a door that was stuck or something. And anyway, he told the girls, get out now. And they literally jumped out of the window, hit the ground. And I don't think it ended up blowing up, but the point was, you know, he was able to give that command, and they were that responsive to his command. And it was just a result of his training.
That was the most impressive story to me of the whole book.
It was impressive, yeah.
Because they didn't say, why, what, what's wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It means you have to be really careful with your words.
Yeah, you do.
And along with that, and being careful with your words, I know even with no, you know, for the most part, Jesse, he'll stop when you get a good strong no. But I have to teach Jaden to not overuse no with Jesse. Because if they're just playing, and he gets one of Jaden's toys, and Jaden goes off on, no, no, that's not a no situation. You know, like, that's not something that, obviously, you don't want him to have that. We got to deal with that different. But not to overuse no or stop, you know, like, I mean, we want them, when they feel we're stopped, to make it stop, so we do not overuse it in other situations where, you know,
yeah,
carry that weight.
And one thing you're getting into there is interaction with the kids, you know. And you know, he's not exactly disciplining the younger one, but he's not in a position to be authority over them, but he can communicate. That gets a little bit tricky, too, trying to sort that out. Because I know we had kids, we had a little bit more of an age gap in our kids, and the older ones felt like they could boss the younger ones around. And sometimes we even left them in charge as babysitters. There was enough of a gap there. But at times you want to be careful not to have it to where they're bossing each other around. That's your job, not theirs. So that, depending on how you would see the line being there, I would see a line being drawn there somewhere along the way. Say, hey, you're not the one in charge. You know, don't tell them no or whatever. Unless it's their lives in danger or something. Obviously, they're trying to help. But all right, let's look at the next one. These are similar, but just different scenarios. Describes it as a touchy situation. And this is one where you have a young infant in your arms and the infant's grabbing your glasses and wanting to pull them off your face, or you know, maybe grab your beard or something. In this case, it was glasses. But have you seen this? I think everybody who's had an infant has seen this. My brother wasn't real big on training his kids real well in this way, and I remember him sitting there holding his oldest one time when he was still infantish or maybe close to toddler, and he was over our house, and we had like a nice little house plant sitting on the windowsill, and his boy just reached out and grabbed it and threw it on the ground and busted the plant up. And he says, "Oh, hey," you know, and he picks it up and sticks it up there, and nothing followed. I was like, "What?" And it wasn't so much the plant, although that bothered me, but it was just sort of the attitude, the lack of response and the lack of training in the first place. So he's talking about training so that doesn't happen, because kids will do this. They just, they don't mean evil by it particularly, although I think eventually they do get to where they actually are being belligerent when they do this sometimes. But at first, it's just a kind of a curiosity thing. They just want to, they see something that looks interesting, they want to put their hand around it and grab it. And you need to be able to tell them no. And notice how he says, lower your voice, don't raise it. In other words, you don't want to train your kids that you have to be yelling before they listen to you. We've talked about that. He has a humorous story in the book. Again, it wasn't one of the ones I included here, where Nancy might help remember exactly how it goes, but it's wasn't it like a neighbor? He had a mule or something that was trained to listen only to a calm voice, and he was yelling, and the animal wouldn't listen because it wasn't used to listening to yelling. It expected a calm voice, which I thought was kind of funny. So with a calm voice, you just say no. Again, a flick or a snap or a switch or, you know, whatever you decide is the appropriate instrument for the occasion, and inflict pain. And he says there quickly comes a time when your word alone is sufficient to gain obedience. You don't have to do the flicking. You don't have to do the snapping or whatever. You just say no, and then they pull back. They're trained. Pretty much, if anybody wants to make a comment on that, they can. This is going to get a little bit repetitive in one sense, but I like the variety that he includes here. These are, again, classic cases of infants needing training. Talks about bowls in babies. We've all seen this one, right? A mother clumsily holds her cereal bowl at arm's length as she wrestles her infant for supremacy. Bad idea. He said when she places the bowl out of the baby's reach, the baby is led to believe that the only objects that are off limits are those that are out of reach. Doesn't have to be any obedience. It's just a matter of if I can't reach it, oh, well, okay, I guess I can't reach it. He's saying to train him, put the bowl within easy reach. Again, this is just another variation of, house-proof the child rather than child-proof the house, if you want to get right down to it. So he says when he reaches for it, no, thump his hand. He'll pull his hand back. Repeat the action in a calm voice, and after several times, you'll be able to eat in peace. That's the beautiful thing about this. It makes it peaceful for everybody. And he makes the point of here several times, the kids are happier. Kids don't like being disobedient. I know that. I mean, in one sense, they do that when they have a chance, but they're really not happy in that state. Kids are happier when they are obedient and when they're trained well. And you're happier. Your family's happier. Your neighbors are happier. Everybody is happier. It makes for peace everywhere. And it's wonderful. And when it's not there, it's horrible. And everybody knows the pain of being around some parents who have done a poor job of training their children. Those parents learn very quickly. Nobody wants to have us over because of our kids. Well, that should be a giant clue. And yeah, maybe people aren't as tolerant as they should be of kids or what have you, but if parents are doing a good job training their kids, that shouldn't be an issue.
I wish Linda, Beth, and Aaron were here to talk about this, because they're doing such a good job with
Bob. Yeah.
It's so funny to watch him when he does something that he knows they've trained him not to do.
Yeah.
Before they even do anything, he just has this look of horror, like, oh no, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, I have watched them, and they're great, and they've I think they've read this book, haven't they, or they have access to it now? Okay, it's interesting because they've picked up on some of these principles, I think, and put them in the...
She'll explain the Brian.
What's that?
Where the Brian understands what all she's saying, but Linda will explain the
Brian. Yeah.
What, you know, why not to do it, whatever, and that he's not supposed to do it. And I'm like she is, but I'm amazed at...
Yeah. Yeah, they're doing a good job. He says, never too young to train. He says, a newborn soon needs training. Parents who put off training until their child is old enough to discuss issues or receive explanations will find he's become a terror long before he can tie his shoes. So, I mean, again, I didn't emphasize this early on in the series. When I read that statement, I thought, that is really true. And I think, well, I won't say why, but I felt like that was a deficiency that he addressed in what we've done so far, and that's why I really like this material. He gives the example here. As a mother begins to lower her child into the crib, he stiffens, takes a deep breath, and bellows. So even at an age where they're not even old enough to be grabbing glasses or crawling across the room and touching something, there's a rebellion that can take place in the crying process. Now, he makes a distinction here that, you know, crying is the baby's only communication. So it's not like you want to make all crying bad. But there's crying because of a need, and then there's crying because I want my way. And as a parent, you need to figure out which one you're dealing with. And he recommends in this case that, you know, if it's crying for a need, obviously you would meet it. But if it's crying I want my way, you just you put him in the room, let him cry. And there's no response to the crying. So he's not particularly, and this is really young, he's not particularly switching him or something like that at this point. He's just letting him cry and letting him see that crying doesn't get him anywhere. What do you think about that? Okay, we're really pushing it back to very, very young at this point. I know people, you know, there's some struggle with this. Oh, but he's crying, you know. And you do want to check. You want to make sure that, you know, they're not wet, you know their feeding schedule. You as a parent are a better judge, and you won't be perfect in your judgment. Maybe you give the benefit of the doubt, but at some point you're going to go, this is just rebellious crying. And you can even tell there's a certain kind of crying that's the way it's done, even the arching of the back and the, you know, that kind of, as opposed to, you know what I'm saying? You, as a parent, you hear the tones. You hear the difference. Jason, you're going to say something.
I've heard a number of people talk about, you know, when you're letting the baby cry it out, as you call it. So they would start by, you know, the first time they'd let the baby cry 5 minutes, and they go over to it the next time 6 or something like that, and they kind of build it up. Is that, I don't know, what do you think about that? He doesn't really address that kind of thing.
Yeah, he doesn't go into that much detail.
Let them cry the whole time until they stop,
I can see that working. I don't know that we could make any hard, fast rules. We're already in the realm of kind of practical or wisdom in a sense. I think as long as the idea is that you recognize the different kinds of crying and what you're trying to instill, whether you have a nuance of training that looks like this versus, you know, the 5, 10, 15, whatever pattern you have, or whether you just, you know, go cold turkey and let them cry it out for a half hour. I mean, I don't know that I'd have a problem with either way myself. Anybody else have thoughts? What do you guys think? Right, yeah.
Right. And that's, I mean, even now, though, we still have a hard time going to sleep because she's starting to develop more fears and, you know, different things like that. So she'll cry a lot sometimes. And so I'll just go in and I'll give her a hug. And she's still, you know, she's still laying in her bed, but I'll give her a hug. And I'll say, no, we're right here. Nothing's going to happen to you. You know, give her kisses and say, now, you're welcome to cry, but you cannot scream, you know?
Yeah. A good distinction there too.
Because she does. She gets these, I don't want to go to bed sick, and then she gets scared, and it's a combination of everything. So I'm like, it's okay if you're crying. That's fine.
Yeah.
They say, you are not allowed to scream and call out my name unless you, you know, are pleading or something. I try to make that decision for her, but it reassures her that you're there, but it also doesn't give in to what she's wanting if you're, you know, if they're just throwing a fit to resist whatever you're needing.
Yeah, I like some of those distinctions that you're making. And because we're working from the principles here, which is, you know, we want to, we don't want to reward rebellion, and but rather we want to discourage rebellion. It's just like we said about training in righteousness. You want to encourage good behavior and discourage bad behavior. At that level, that's how you do it, by just even whether you pick them up or how you talk to them, like you say, and the distinction you made about, you know, it's okay to cry, because we don't want to teach our kids that we have to be stoics. It's okay to cry. It's okay to have a fear, you know, and be afraid, but not, but screaming and rebellious kind of response is a whole different kind of thing.
And it's okay for the mommy to be miserable while she's crying, because otherwise your heart gets hard towards it and you don't want that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. No, that's rebellion.
You know, that's rebellion, but then also, like, the people around you, like, are going to think that something is wrong with your kid.
Right.
And
or so, something wrong with what you're doing.
Yeah. And so,
child abuser.
I'm telling teachers that, you know, I don't mind if you're crying because you're upset. That is something that all of us do, you know. But if you're going to scream like this, that's going to be an extra stake.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Good, again, good distinction. Yeah.
Well, the point of training is usually to handle a common situation that's going to come up, like don't touch something, because that can be troublesome if you take them anywhere, or also can help the, protect them if they're about to put a fork into a, you know, electrical socket or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's an intentional training setup, like they mentioned earlier, where you put things within reach and train them not to. And also a common thing is putting down a child to sleep. If we eventually show them, well, after long enough of you crying, we will come in and pick you up. You've trained them during the day to do one thing, but the training stops all of a sudden when they try to go to sleep.
Yeah.
That would eventually, when you tell them to stop, possibly during the middle of the day and what you've already trained them, well, they've learned, I can do something else. I can start crying, and eventually you will pick me up, and then you've just tore down what you've been training during your day.
So, that's true.
You know, you're always training. You're either training them to do the right thing or training them to do the wrong thing.
Exactly. So. Yeah. Yep. Very good. Good point. Good principle. Steps to obedience. This is a case for his daughter had a fascination with crawling upstairs. You can just imagine what that could lead to. We had something similar. Our youngest, wasn't Jason, but our youngest was a real climber, and he could climb out of his crib and hit the ground and ran to the front door and opened the door and ran out into the street. He was compelled to run out into the street. I have no idea why. I have no idea why. So he could be put down for a nap, and lo and behold, there he was, you know, heading out. And it was scary because, you know, Sandy might say, okay, shoot, got him down for a nap. I'm going to do my vacuuming. I'm going to make a phone call I needed to make. I'm going to put some laundry on. And suddenly, whoa, where's little guy? You know, so here is one of those kind of scenarios. And apparently he had some trouble, even with the spanking. She just seemed to keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. And you probably run into these situations as a parent. He finally came up with something a little bit creative here to get the point across. And in addition to all the spanking that was done, he laid the switch at the lower stair. And from what he reports here, that did the trick. Great if you can think of those things, right? What if that hadn't worked? He didn't say. But, you know, anyhow, it does bring in the idea that sometimes a little creativity, there's some room for creativity in some of these things, as long as it's all in the same spirit of what you're trying to do. You're trying to put across to the kid, you do the bad thing, you're going to face problems. And he got that point across by having it sitting on the stair. Great. Any thoughts on that? Next one is one of my favorite ones. It's the Amish boy one. I think you said you like it too, Mark, right? I just love this story. Yeah.
I have a question about the switch on the stair.
Okay, sure.
At what point is that, like, you teach them to respond to no or do what you've been told.
Right.
He's not going to always have that reminder of when he's thinking to do something wrong. Oh, look, there's that thing right there to remind me not to do it.
Right, right.
And so, like, at what point do you take that away? And, you know, no, you don't need a reminder. I've told you what to do.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, obviously, he did. He didn't keep that on the stair for the rest of her life, I'm sure. I think he probably just, I'm guessing, he doesn't tell us. And, you know, maybe somebody would look at it and say, well, I just don't think we just need to just keep spanking him. And, you know, I'm not going to go against somebody who wants to go that route. But
doesn't that kind of go along with what you said about house-proof, don't house-proof your kid? That's kind of like house-proofing your kid in a way. He had to move something in his house. Like, that'd be like putting an extra lock on the door that he can't reach.
Yeah.
You know, that's not...
Well, he wasn't preventing her from going to the stairs. He wasn't like putting a gate across the stairway. He was putting a reminder there. It was kind of like a form of communication is the way I'd see it. And maybe he's pushing the envelope on that. Well, maybe we say, hey, you're not being a purist here like you taught us. And, you know, if that's your takeaway and you want to do it the other way when you get your kiddos, well, I'm sure he won't complain to you. But it was another idea to throw into the mix. I don't particularly have a problem with it, you know. But you have to be careful that it doesn't go too far, obviously. Yeah.
Just one thought on that. I mean, he didn't put the switch there so that he wouldn't have to spank his kid. He was putting the switch there because simply spanking the kid didn't seem totally effective by itself. So he was like trying to reinforce, not prevent having to spank her, is what I understood from the story. But I mean, like you said, he wouldn't have to do it that way, but
no.
He might go a little bit different.
I have a question about, not the actual discipline part of it, but the example of it. When it comes to the stairs. So when you're disciplining them on something or training them on something that you are going to later let them do, because right now, I don't stop Jesse when he goes towards the stairs. I follow him to make sure he gets the stairs okay. Now, I do not let him come the other direction because he does not know how to go down them yet.
Yeah.
And so when he gets to the top, I do, like, I lay on his belly, I swing his legs, lay him on his belly, so like I'm teaching him how to go down. But like I'm pointing up a specific thing, not the discipline of it. But do you think there is? I don't want to say detriment, because that's too harsh. But like keeping them from the stairs, knowing that they're going to be using the stairs when they learn it anyway. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, why? I guess I'm just concerned that when you tell them no, or stop them, spank them on something, that you're eventually going to turn around and let them start doing.
Yeah, I think he's, yeah, obviously an individual boundaries that you set as a parent are at your discretion. I will say if you allow too much freedom, you're going to make a lot of work for yourself, especially at a younger age. Now, once they get older, obviously, I'm sure he didn't keep her from going up the stairs the rest of her life. She grew up, you know, but he was viewing that as a danger for her at that age and something she apparently really liked to do and led her off into other areas. I mean, I want to put boundaries on kids just leaving the room and wandering off somewhere, whether the stairs or not, myself. I mean, that's especially if you're out and about, you know. I get really troubled when I see parents with little kids and their kid wanders out of the room out of sight of them and maybe everybody else, and they don't seem to notice. That's a breakdown in parenting, in my opinion. Maybe it's minor, but it could be major, depending on what they got into. So... No, go ahead.
It's just another example of age-appropriate things that Jaden can do things that Jesse can't yet. So I would think that would be okay for him to realize that. And just like tons of things in life are that way.
I see. I'm sorry.
Eventually, my daughters are going to, you know, court men, but it doesn't mean when they're 12. Oh well, you're going to do it anyway. So.
Well, yeah. I feel like you have to train them to respond to a. Your voice, a no, when they want to go upstairs, when you can't help one of them upstairs. I see it similar to swimming. Swimming is good. Training your kid to swim at a young age is important so they don't die. But only when you are there to help them. Otherwise, it's no, you can't go swimming. But swimming's okay, only when I'm there. They don't have to understand that part. Swimming's okay, climbing up the stairs can be okay, only when you're there to do that. Otherwise, they should respond to no and not climb the stairs when you're busy with guests or friends, or when you can't go out to the pool at the time, you know. So.
Because if you think about it, probably half or more of all the things you want to keep your kids from doing is dangerous are going to be someday. You know, cooking on the stove, walking in the street, plugging stuff in the outlet, or even holding a gun, you know. Eventually it's okay, but not right now, you know. I think it's going to apply a lot.
There's just not as big a gap between being okay and not what it seems, so.
Well, rather than go on at this point, we've kind of reached a time period where I think we're going to go ahead and stop the class. Bring these articles back with you next time, please, because I do want to go on and cover the front and back of the second page. We've just gotten the front and back in the first page. I feel like this is pretty worthwhile to go through this. This is something that, not deliberately, but I sort of overlooked in what we covered earlier. And when I saw this, I was like, ooh, this is good. I said that about quite a few things in this book, actually. I just recently was exposed to it. I knew of him, but I'd never read his book. And when I read it, I was pretty impressed with it. Like I said, there were a few areas where I took issue, but on balance, I thought he was one of the most practical guides that I had seen so far, in my opinion. So, Father, thank you for our time. Thank you for the wisdom that's already present in the class, the ability that they have for discernment and to think through these things, the willingness and desire to do these things. And we know that's your work in the hearts of your people. And thank you for this opportunity for us to discuss these things together. Thank you for those who, like Michael and others, who have been able to communicate to us principles that we need to understand and give good practical examples. It's very helpful to be able to look at things like this. So thank you for these things in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.